made the world, and it was God that made the sun. Brother, it was the man that made this atomic bomb. It's gonna turn us to dust. It's gonna turn us to dust. Because this wicked world, our God above can't
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Richard Wollstonecraft. We're going to be discussing his new film, The Second Coming, Volume 2. Richard, it's great having you back on the show.
It's a pleasure, mate. How have you been?
Excellent. So this film is a sequel to Volume 1. When that came out about a couple years ago?
Originally it was meant to be one movie. And it kind of expanded into this kind of, like, you know, a very unusual entity, which is a low-budget epic. I shot it around the same time as I did that film, The Last Days of Joe Blow, a documentary I did on the porno industry, and the porn star Joe Blow, whose real name is Michael Tierney, who's the nephew of the famous actor Lawrence Tierney. And I shot it around the same time. Then, and originally, each segment of the film, and there are seven segments, was meant to be around 15 minutes long and make, I don't know, a 100-minute feature. But each segment blew out to about half an hour each. And around that time, I think Nymphomaniac, Volume 1 and 2 came out. And I thought, that's a good thing. You know, I'll divide it into Kill Bill 1 and 2, whatever, you know. And just do that, and I'll get an epic three-hour movie out of it. And this was definitely something a bit more... experimental, a bit more avant-garde, and taking risks, and that was the kind of project it was, and that's why I wanted to do it. I tend to work in kind of indie genre films. That's the kind of thing I normally like to do, but with this project I wanted to do something different, to see if I could expand myself and just try out a few new ideas and see what worked and see what didn't. And so that's kind of what was part of the animus of doing it.
So is this, you're saying, is it going to be in three volumes, or this is official volume two, is that, that's the final?
This is it, yeah. I mean, unless someone, gives me $1 million in 10 years to make a third one, I'd probably consider it, but, this is it. But it was, as I said, it was meant to be one film. I decided to, divide it in two, because otherwise it would be a three-hour low-budget movie, which is not, low-budget films should be short. Both volume one and volume two are 85 minutes long, which... it's a quick study. It's not like many of these superhero films are going for 2.5 hours or whatever, and are dead boring, even though they've had $200 million spent on them. This is two features made for $100,000, and I think it's fairly interesting, and they're a bit different. Obviously, I was originally inspired. A couple of things inspired me, really. I was just sort of thinking creatively, and I was thinking about the poet William Butler Yeats.
This is based on his poem, and his poem is quoted throughout the film.
Yeah, yeah. And really, the poem is a kind of apocalyptic poem. So it deals with ideas of apocalypse and, kind of like millennial kind of concerns, that kind of thing, which I think is still in the air very much now. It was just something that I was also inspired, I guess, by... discordant aspects, like the film work of Kenneth Anger, for example. I was inspired by the films of Andy Warhol and Paul Morrissey, like Trash and Heat, that kind of thing. The cinema of Terrence Malick, Lars von Trier's Dogma, the way he would just shoot on these low budget cameras. And I'd just come off the back of doing this documentary on the porn industry, where I'd seen a lot of people make porn films with these little mini DV cameras. And I had a mini DV camera that was pretty good quality one, and I thought, well, I'm going to try and make a feature, on this, and then, just see how it comes out, and make it kind of lo-fi, deliberately lo-fi. Because everyone now concentrates, I run a film festival, the Melbourne Underground Film Festival, everyone's always obsessed with, it's 4K, and it's, the picture quality is incredible, and, but I often find that may be true, and they spend a lot of time technically on it. But the film itself is dull, or technical quality is brilliant, when the film is also brilliant, but if the film just has technical quality, the film isn't interesting, you know what I mean? I think that's... So it was a bit of a reaction against that kind of thing, and another film that influenced it was Godard's Vive Sur... What's it called? Vive Sur... My Life to Live. Vive Sur La Vie, I think it's pronounced. And I had the Criterion Collection of that, and I'd watched that around the time I just started to make this, and I was reading like the liner notes of the Criterion Collection, and it had like a synopsis. Like, it was like two or three pages written by Godard. And from that, he made a 90-minute feature. And then I liked the idea of not working from a script. So I thought I would write a synopsis for 7 short stories. And that, you know, in my travels shooting this other documentary and also my other travels personally, I would, you know, attempt to shoot 7 short stories. And then, of course, each one got more elaborate and, you know, each one became almost like a little mini feature. And it was just, you know, it was just bizarre. And it, you know, blew out of proportion and took up a lot of my time and kind of energy because, you know, it was a very... you know, kind of like soul-consuming kind of work. I think it's interesting. I mean, I showed Volume 1 to a famous Australian avant-garde filmmaker, Emil Corton Wilson, who's had his work played at Venice and many other major festivals, and he said it's the best thing I've done, and some people might think that.
To be honest, I still prefer Pearls Before Swine.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, it's horses for courses. This will appeal to certain people, and I think Pearls Before Swine will probably appeal to the audience of your podcast more. And obviously, that has a special place in my heart, that film, for working with Boyd Rice. And it was a great period there in the 90s, and I think the film was prophetic and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it was just, it was interesting. I mean, so you watched Volume 2? Did you enjoy that as much as Volume 1? What were your thoughts?
I preferred Volume 2. I watched the entire thing in one setting. I would say it was a great film in its entirety. My only critique is I think you go overboard with the sort of, like, you spend maybe like 1 minute pauses of a man slowly walking down a corridor.
Yeah.
That's my only critique.
Yeah, I mean, I've never really watched it as a 3-hour film. I've only ever watched it as, you know, 2 85-minute films. I've never actually sat down and watched the whole thing, you know, in like a 3-hour sitting. I imagine it could be a bit ponderous. I think at 85 minutes, even if the film is a bit ponderous, it still moves quickly. There's still a lot happening. There's 3 stories that are going to happen, each about half an hour each, or in the later one, you know, 20 minutes each. And, you know, it was just something different I wanted to try. And, you know, it was me just kind of having a different... I mean, I guess with each new film I do, I try and explore a different kind of aesthetic in a way. Like, you know, the Last Days of Joe Blow had a different kind of aesthetic to this. The Beautiful and Damned had a different kind of aesthetic. Pearls Before Swine did. I mean, most filmmakers, they find an aesthetic they like, and then they stick to it. But I like the idea of exploring and experimenting with different kinds of aesthetics. Like, you know, Pearls Before Swine was shot on Super 16, and had a more kind of glossy kind of feel to it, and, you know, more, I guess, it was a different kind of style of filmmaking. But I like to actually change it around. In my new film I just shot, The Debt Collector, which I think is my 7th or 8th feature, I shot that different again. I shot that on a 4K camera. It's definitely got all this... I decided to go for real quality, you know what I mean, for this high quality everyone talks about, but I also decided to try and make a good film at the same time.
And there's a lot of traveling involved. You said it was a relatively low budget. You show pretty much, let's see, Thailand, Australia, LA, London, number of other places, Barcelona.
It has more locations than a Bond film. I mean, you know, and it's paid on the catering budget of, you know, like a day or two of a Bond film. So that's kind of extraordinary. You know, I basically got some money to make this porn documentary, and I sort of had $100,000 left over, which I could then, you know, travel with and, you know, use. I guess that, you know, could be considered my fee or whatever. So I was able to then I just invested it in this project and was, you know, I went on, I don't know how many trips to shoot this film. I must have gone on about 4 or 5. I mean, I love traveling. I mean, I love living in Australia. But the great thing about Australia, it is the best country in the world, but only if you travel a lot. If you just stay here all the time, it can be a bit, I don't know, like a, what's the word? Like a country town compared to, say, New York or somewhere. But if you, you know, regularly visit New York, LA, London, Europe, you know, Asian cities like, you know, Tokyo, Bangkok, etc., Bali or whatever, you know, you get a really great feel for the world, and you have a great base, you know, and then also you don't feel so colloquial because you're traveling so often.
Do you have a favorite locale out of everywhere you visited?
I really like, I mean, that is not a whole lot of really amazing footage there. I really enjoyed Switzerland. I went to CERN. I mean, if there's one thing that connects all the stories, I guess it's really, I mean, just to give the kind of like the meta structure of the film, it's about two different groups of people who are attempting to invoke the Second Coming. I guess one could be considered black magicians and one could be considered white. I got this again from Yeats's biography, where he had a kind of magical war with Crowley when they're both in the Golden Dawn.
And Crowley is referenced with the whole 777. That's in the beginning of the first volume.
It's true, absolutely. There are pictures of him. You know, Kristen's character at the end is kind of like taking Crowley's work and applying it to science and to a kind of particle physics and you know, unusual ideas like that of mixing, like, you know, the occult with science, and, you know, I mean, this, you know, all this kind of interesting stuff that someone like Jack Parsons did, for example. So, you know, it was you know, I thought it was interesting, and yeah, and so I went ahead and did it.
So you're saying it was like there's like the theme of the Black Lodge and the White Lodge?
Exactly. You know, I mean, look, when I saw the new Twin Peaks, and I'm not going to compare myself, so I guess I will. Why not compare? I mean, there's definitely a bit self-indulgent. This new film, of all my films, is probably the most self-indulgent of my films. As I said, it is a little ponderous at times. It may be a little slow. Could have been passing up a bit. But, like, you know, it has a unusual structure, like, say, the new Twin Peaks did. And it creates a kind of weird world, you know, where there's these kind of warring elements and, you know, how do they all connect up? And you have, I mean, some of that you have to do in your own head. And what was amazing is obviously I wrote, I mean, I had seven synopsises and I shot seven short stories in seven countries and then also other bits and pieces interlinking things in other countries. And the fact that it even makes sense at all is a miracle to me. And there are parts of it that don't make sense, which of course is, you know, fine with me as well. Or, you know, exactly what is going on, or, you know,
yeah, especially if you watch volume one, it doesn't really make sense until volume two. Volume one doesn't make that much sense, especially if you're watching like the first half of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I do think that you need to watch volume two to get what I'm trying to do. You know, I mean, it's a tough ask to make people watch a 3-hour experimental film. As I said, I do normally work in genre where, you know, it's like a strong storyline and, you know, like things rocket along to a conclusion, and, you know, I made some experimental films when I was a teenager. One called 16 Red Pencils was my most experimental film I made as a teenager. That was deliberately avant-garde and experimental. You know, I showed that at some Super 8 film groups and things in the 80s, and I've always had that side to me. I think all filmmakers do, and that, you know, I think it's good to continue to explore that more experimental side of you, because then you can bring that. It just makes you a better filmmaker. Like, I'm definitely a better filmmaker for having made this film. You know, just being able to handle such a large, you know, tapestry of characters and everything, and to do it all on this incredibly low budget and so many countries, and, you know, really, it's quite, I don't know how the hell I did it, really. It was kind of a bit shambolic. And it's got amazing kind of, like, interesting celebrities. I mean, that's the thing.
I think Jim Goad and Adam Parfrey were in it.
Absolutely, and Kim Fowley's in one, and William Margold, the porn star, and Pete Doherty from the Libertines. I mean, Pete Doherty from the Libertines, isn't it? I mean, this is, you know, all these kind of very interesting people. And, you know, other people like Lisa Carver, Yodel Partridge, obviously Boyd Rice, Jean Gregoritz, who else is in it? Some really interesting, like, an ally actor, Jesse Merlin, he's really amazing. A whole bunch of interesting Australian actors like Kristen Condon, Gregory Packus, who plays a boyfriend. Frank Housen is in it. I mean, you know, it's an interesting collection of people that I think, you know, it has that kind of like Warhol superstar kind of thing, you know, to it, you know, like in the sense of, like, you know, these people are like famous in their own lunchtime.
And,
you know,
Richard Wollstonecraft is in it.
And I am in it as Richard Masters. It's my acting pseudonym I use when I act in my own films. And, I mainly did that as I needed some kind of linking character for it all to make sense. And I was always there. I was the only person of the crew who was always there. So I just cast myself. But also, I'm a ham actor, you know. This is definitely my biggest part I've ever given myself. I'm basically Boyd Rice's emissary. Boyd plays Bill Cucullin, who's, I guess, the black magician. He's meant to be a figure like say, Steve Bannon, say. If he was involved with terrorism and the occult. That's who he is. You know, obviously Bannon is not involved with either of those things and wouldn't be interested in those things. But, you know, it's a character like that. And, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, Trump and all this stuff, even the alt-right hadn't even been invented. Maybe it was just being invented around 2012, 2013 when I shot it. You know, it does reflect almost the duality at the moment between, you know, like, the, you know, like, the, you know, I guess what's like the new left and the new, sorry, the new left and the new right, and, you know, this kind of weird divide and infighting that's going on, and they seem to be sabotaging, and no one seems to be getting anywhere. You know, there's an element of that. I mean, you know, most of these people in the film, what they're trying to do does not work. You know what I mean? Like, they're kind of glorious failures in their attempts to invoke the second coming, in the sense that, like, trying to bring on such a huge event through human willpower is not possible, if you know what I mean.
So what's the whole deal with the character who's the assassin and he's killing off all the nuclear scientists?
Yeah. I mean, that's part of, there are lots of kind of, like, you know, hidden backstories to many of these things. There are kind of, there are two groups. One is led by Boyd Rice's character, Bill Cullen, and I'm his emissary. What's my character's name?
You're Richard Masters?
Yeah, no, that's my, I see, anyway, look, I can't even remember. Sorry, but Ivan Ocean is played by Bruce LaBruce, and he is, he's like the good witch, or the good, you know, he's like the good version of Boyd Rice's character, and he is experimenting in Ireland with, using things like Christianity and bringing kind of Christian mysticism into science to, again, possibly, you know, use the God particle, CERN, all this stuff. They're all basically trying to, you know, the return of Jesus Christ or bring on the apocalypse. You know what I mean? That's what both parties are attempting to do in various ways. And that's sort of like the, you know, it's kind of, you know, in that sense, it is a bit like, say, something like Kenneth Anger, who deals with subjects of, you know, magic and, you know, mystical ideas, and the films are kind of spells in a way, and, you know, things like that.
And then you have Jim Goad's character. Jim Goad's character is a kind of like a white nationalist terrorist who blows up a mosque in somewhere in the South, and he visits
does.
A Confederate monument. But
he
then
does.
You see him put in some of his personal information where he talks about parts of, like, the Redneck Manifesto when he visits that bookstore.
It's true. He, he plays, Jim Goad is not a right-wing terrorist, but he's a right-wing, a major right-wing figure, so I think it's a coup. I mean, Jim is a really amazing presence. When I worked with Boyd, ever since Pearls Before Swan, I wanted to work with Jim Goad. And he came out to Australia. A media personality by the name of John Safran brought him up to Australia about 15 years ago, and then I'd paid for his flight and was bringing him out to the Melbourne Underground Film Festival to be the head honcho and, like, you know, jury member and programs and films, and also probably act in one of my films. And he wasn't allowed to come into the country. He flew to Hawaii and they wouldn't let him get on the flight, because when he was here the first time, you know, he made comments, you know, in relation to that book he wrote, Shit Magnet, you know, where he talked about, you know, violence against women, and I think someone had complained, probably the ABC had complained to immigration, so he, you know, was not allowed back into the country. So that was like, fuck, that kind of got foiled working with him in that way. So I had to basically go to him, and he lives in Georgia, so I went to Georgia and shot that. That's where Stone Mountain is, that monument, and I think that's interesting because there's all these monuments being kind of removed at the moment, you know what I mean? And there's talk of removing Stone Mountain, which is an incredibly beautiful monument. It's like fucking Ayers Rock with something carved in it, and they want to fucking knock it down. It would just be so obscene, you know. All this kind of removal of statues and, you know, like, you know, all this cultural Marxist bullshit, taking Shakespeare off the curriculum at universities and putting on some African author who, you know, can hardly string two sentences together. Basically, if you really think about it, what it is it's a neo-Maoist cultural revolution. And what the hell a neo-Maoist cultural revolution is doing, happening under President Donald Trump, the fact that this is all going on with Donald Trump as president, I mean, this shows you that the world is currently ruled by two different groups of people. One evil, like my film says, and one good. I guess Bruce LaBruce would represent Donald Trump. He would hate that. But, you know, I mean, it's not that obvious or whatever. But, like, you know, essentially, I would consider Trump to represent the forces of light and God and the globalist agenda, and Soros and people like that to represent the forces of evil, you know, and the devil. I mean, quite literally the devil.
So which team is the Jim Goad character? Is he affiliated with one of the teams?
Yes, he's on the side of Broad Rice, the side of darkness, you know, because he's committing an act of political violence. Even though I am sympathetic to the alt-right and the alt-light, I'm not sympathetic to political terrorism of any
type.
Was
there any controversy about, because you had to film a particular mosque and there was reference to terrorism, was there any controversy about filming that?
Not really. We just all shot it, you know, kind of underground, but we did worry about that. I mean, a little bit. You know, I mean, Jim was very friendly. I mean, I must have spent about a week or 10 days in Georgia. He had a lot of writing to do, so I wasn't able to see him all the time. But whenever he was free, we would hang out, you know, we'd eat, and then we'd go up and shoot for a few hours. He's very easygoing. He'd actually studied acting, and he had I think he does have a desire to act, or at least used to when he was younger. In the 80s, he'd done an acting course in New York City. And I'm amazed that no one else has used him, because he's fantastic. He did act in a short film where he, you know, was some kind of like thing where he beats up a woman, but it was kind of like a, you know, like a Jim Thompson kind of thing, you know what I mean? Like a kind of seedy noir kind of thing. And I've seen the stills from it, but the film was lost. So this is still the only actual cinema thing that he's ever done. He's apparently seen it and he's fine with it. He just and so that's good. I hope I should actually have a chat to him about it and get his more detailed opinion.
And then there's Adam Parfrey's character. He's the one who says to destroy the cell phone.
Yes. I mean, Adam Parfrey would be working with Boyd's character and my character. I think that is part of. You know, I mean, I just wanted to, you know, I guess he would be representing the forces of evil, I guess, you know, which Adam Parfrey, I don't know, he represented evil, but you know what I mean. He just did a little cameo. I stayed up at his house. He lives just outside of Seattle in this really kind of like interesting area that's kind of a lot of like, not islands, or like, yeah, I guess islands connected by bridges and on the outskirts of Seattle. You know, he lives around there, and it's very rustic and kind of like sea resort, you know, like fishing village kind of thing. And, you know, we spent about 3 or 4 days there, stayed a couple of nights, and, you know, we really got along. And, you know, and then, you know, he obviously just took that little cameo, you know.
And the music in the film is by David Thrussell.
Yes, it's by David Thrussell. And, you know, it's got... We open with two country and western songs that deal with, you know, ideas of damnation. My friend David Thrussell owns a company called the Omni Recording Corporation, where he releases old country and western stuff, old electronic music, Moog music, this kind of stuff. And, he was able to supply us with some interesting, you know, both original music and also, you know, classic stuff that we would have the license through him.
The opening reminds me a little bit of the opening of The Hills Have Eyes, if you've seen that film.
A little bit. You know, I mean, a film that's actually a little bit like, which actually surprised me, because Terrence Malick was a bit of an inspiration, in the sense that, you know, the ponderousness of it, you noticed it's a bit slow, you know. And one thing you notice about Terrence Malick's films is they're a bit slow. People just wandering around the desert, or people wandering up and down, you know, wherever, like a beach or a pier, or, you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like existential quality. I was attempting to reach for that kind of thing a little bit with this film, and, you know, I just thought it was... interesting, but the film Knight of Cups by Terrence Malick, it's really weird. If you watch the beginning, it's almost the same beginning as my film, and it was both shot, we shot at the same time, 2012-2013, and there's another scene, both of them open on the roads outside of Las Vegas, and there's another scene in the film where one of the main characters is kind of like just, you know, what's it called, existentially lost or whatever, by the pier in Venice Beach, the famous pier with the merry-go-round and what's it called, all that stuff.
Oh,
and,
that's the scene with the writer who says that Charles Manson put a curse on Western civilization.
Yeah, that's Jim Gregoritz. So it's all quite interesting.
What is it? And Charles Manson, that just kind of goes into the whole theme, because Charles Manson wanted to bring about an apocalypse in a sense.
You know, I think Manson is someone I wanted to bring in a kind of Manson theme there a little bit. I mean, it just ties into the kind of apocalyptic Yeatsian thing, you know, the rough beach slouching toward Bethlehem to be born. That event has always struck me as being more than just about the murder of a few celebrities and a couple of industrial, on the industrial, the two Libyankas. There's something about that case. It's like the death of the 1960s. And almost from then on, you know, this other kind of thing began to grow, this almost dialectical reaction that many of the characters like Boyd Rice, Jim Goad, Adam Parfrey, began to express, you know, a new kind of way of looking at the world that was diametrically opposed to, I guess, what would be called the hippie, you know, big generation, you know, free love, and, you know, all that kind of bullshit that's now predominant, you know. So I wanted to make that point, and, you know, I don't necessarily think Manson was doing that, but, you know, there was something ritualistic about the murders, and there was something, it could have been some kind of spell, and I just wanted to play with the idea of that. So I had Gene Gregoritz's character investigating that and sort of getting lost in it.
So, yeah, you deal with these, you deal with this theme, so one group wants to bring about the apocalypse in a cultist sense, and is there another group, are they coming from a, the sense of the second coming of Christ?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I think, you know, both are hoping to succeed. And, you know, I guess the whole point of it is that both are kind of doomed to failure, you know what I mean? Because even the one that would, I guess, be considered Christian or good, God does not need assistance to bring on the second coming. He will reappear when he needs to. Of course, he may require human actors to do things. Maybe that's what they were doing. Maybe, you know, in part three of volume three, well, if someone gives me $1 million, let's go do it. You know, we'll come up with some other part three, and that could be like season four of Twin Peaks. You know,
yeah, because the ending is very open ended.
It is. Yeah, I mean, Kristen's character. I won't say what happens, but it's interesting. And it was exploring that kind of thing, and it was nothing really like what I'd done before, which is why Owen O'Hearn, that's the character I play. The names Cú Chulainn, Owen O'Hearn, and Ivan Ozen are from the poetry of Wimberley Yeats. They are characters that appear in his poems, also appear in his writings, that represent certain ideas. And I sort of researched this a bit, and, you know, I mean, there's actually a bibliography in both films. You know, I took that idea from Pasolini's 120 Days of Sodom, where he provides a bibliography, because I thought that's interesting, you know, to provide a kind of intellectual framework for it. I mean, this is definitely being an art wanker a bit, you know, happily admit, you know. But, you know, I still think it's interesting, and it's the kind of film you can watch and see new things, and, you know, it's quite a dark film, you know. It's kind of a horror film in a weird way, even though it's, you know, it's kind of an existential horror film.
What reception gotten from the film so far?
Well, I mean, I just finished it not long ago. I did a little preview screening of it at my festival. The reaction was good there, obviously, but, you know, there are a lot of people I know. Now I'm going to play it at a few festivals. I might put it online the way for free for a little while, the way I did Volume 1. But I had someone interested in releasing the DVD. So if I did that, it would only be for a month. Because I left Volume 1 up. Volume 1 was only meant to be up for a month, but I just left it up. So I might put up Volume 2 for a month, and then, you know, hide them both. Now, I think you can download them. You can download the file. And if you want to pirate the thing all over, fucking, I don't care. Film piracy doesn't worry me. My only thing is, if you've seen my film through what's called a torrent, and you liked it, buy a copy, as long as it's available on DVD or Blu-ray somewhere in the world. This one at the moment isn't, so but hopefully will be. So I think I will put it online free for a month, and then... people in our scene can watch it. Maybe who watch this, we can put the link at the end. I'll probably, you know, put it on Colin Liddell's alt-right site. That's where I put Volume 1. And then, you know, in a month, I'll take it down and go to the distributor and say, okay, let's get this DVD out. Because I like having a physical copy of the film and, you know, look at some... I mean, it's never a film I expected to make a huge amount of money with. As I said, it's an experimental film. But it's not like, you know, when I say... experimental, it's not like, you know, filming a wall and with the colors, you know, there is a storyline, and, you know, it does move along, even though it's a bit ponderous at times. It does move along at a reasonable clip, and each part is only 85 minutes, which is really a short feature. And as I said, if you watch it Volume 1 and then 2 on another day, it's not really that hard to watch.
It's divided up into the chapters, the the lines of the poem are coincided with the stories of the characters.
Absolutely. I mean, that's fucking genius, isn't it? You know what I mean? I mean, I've adapted a poem. Name me one other filmmaker on earth has ever done that. You know, another thing that inspired this film is Stanley Kubrick, when he said, you know, if it can be written, it can be filmed. And I remember that quote. And, you know, that's, you know, I thought, well, I can shoot a poem then. Now, when you shoot a poem, you know, unless it has a, unless it's a long epic poem, it doesn't have a storyline. So, you know, I was able to construct my own storyline and just use the poem as a kind of, you know, like for, to reference the themes and the ideas of what the film was going to be about. You know, it's kind of apocalyptic, you know, apocalypse culture, Adam Pathfry again. It's kind of apocalyptic worry people have at the moment. The sense of doom, the sense of end times that I think is currently around. It's been around probably for a little while now.
We are at the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, Richard, is there anything else you'd like to add about the film?
No. I hope, you know, that the audience here gets something from it. Obviously, put a link to Volume 1 so people can watch Volume 1. And I might let it play at a few more film festivals for a month or two, and then, I don't know, maybe put it online for free in January, maybe, so people can look at it. And then, you know, get the DVD out next year. In the meantime, I'm now moving into a much more fast-paced post-production on my latest feature, which is The Deck Collector, which is a much more genre-driven film starring John Brumpton, who's a famous Australian actor. He's been in a lot of great films. Roger Ward, who's in Turkey Shoot and Mad Max. Andy McPhee, who's in Sons of Anarchy. Mel Kennard, who's been in a lot of great stuff. Kristen Condon. Jack Alice, who's a hot new actor who plays like a neo-Nazi alt-right character. You know, the new film is, I think, the best thing I've ever done. And I think it shows some of the daring I took with this new film, The Second Coming, but it is in a much, much stronger narrative with an incredible cast of local actors. So, you know, that's where I am right now. And obviously, I just finished the 18th Melbourne Underground Film Festival about 10 days ago. So I've just been recovering a little bit from that, having a week or two off, and then moving into new projects and new endeavors.
Richard Wollstonecroft, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
No problem, mate. Hope you're well, and shout out to all the crew. Thanks, mate.